For those whom I haven't met before, I'm a development economist with interests in demography, education, religion, and rationality. And the subject of my talk today is the economics of religion in India. And I'm going to say a little bit about the ideas and approaches that economists are using to study religion and present a brief overview of the kind of research that I've been doing on this subject in India. So what exactly is the economics of religion? Well, a major international study of over 230 countries that was released by the Pew Research Center, which is essentially a Washington-based think tank, showed that about 84% of the world's population currently report a religious affiliation. The economics of religion actually studies this. So I would define it as the application of economic and statistical tools to evaluate the role of religion in society. So for example, as important as they are, for economists of religion, we're not really asking profoundly philosophical or spiritual questions such as, how do I attain salvation? Rather, what we are asking are questions such as, what are the economic costs and benefits to me to believe in salvation? So the economics of religion is looking at the economic theories that elucidate religious change and the socioeconomic attributes of religious communities. The research was pioneered by Gary Becker, Larry Anacone, and others from the Chicago School of Economics, who were essentially interested in non-market behavior arising from social interactions. But the economic study of religion is not new, nor is it restricted to the 21st century. It was Adam Smith who first made reference to the church in The Wealth of Nations, in which he discussed religious competition and wrote in favor of church-state separation. Max Weber, in his very famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, argued that Protestantism encouraged economic growth in northwestern Europe from the 16th century onwards because it encouraged diligence, thrift, frugality, savings, and literacy in order to read the Bible. And it's really against this kind of backdrop that we need to view current studies in the economics of religion. Now, these current studies are really focused on applying the tools of modern economic analysis to an analysis of religious institutions. And as you can see, although they cover a range of areas, I think if you look at these studies, two major themes emerge. First, understanding theoretically what determines religion and religiosity, and secondly, understanding empirically the microeconomic and macroeconomic consequences of religiosity. And this view of religion, which is called the rational choice approach, focuses both on what economists call the supply side, which is the structure of religious organizations, and on the demand side, which is the preferences of consumers. This research is also looking at religious networks, what they call spiritual capital or religious capital. These are simply norms and networks organized on the basis of religion, and this is important particularly in less developed countries because religious networks are important not only for the religious services that they provide, but equally and especially for their non-religious services such as education, and they're providing many insurance functions as well. And this is very important, particularly in the light of a lot of recent work by economists at Princeton and elsewhere who've been looking at the relationship between religion, economics, and terrorism. They've been arguing, for example, that many religious groups, such as the Hamas, have provided social and welfare services in the regions they operate alongside the spiritual services. And it really is in that context that our research in India is relevant. But first, I'd like you to have a look at these two graphs, which simply shows the distribution of religious groups in the world and in India. And what you can see is that while Hindus approximately make up about 15% of the population in the world, they make up over 80% of the population in India. The Muslims are roughly about 23% of world population, and they are about a minority of 150 million people in India, about 15%. So these groups are actually extremely sizable. By way of background, I think it's also useful to look at the incidence of religious conflict between the various religious groups. For example, one of the things that we've done is to assemble a data set of the average number of Hindu-Muslim riots in India based on event study analysis, newspaper reports from the Times of India, Mumbai. And from 1950 to roughly just before the financial crisis, 2006, you can see that the number of riots is showing an upward trend and significant volatility. This is simply the rate of growth of annual GDP per capita over the same period. Now, these two graphs may have absolutely nothing to do with each other, but I think it is striking that the incidence of religion-related violence in India are rising in periods where economic growth in the country has also been increasing. Alternatively, you might think that do we really need to be so concerned about religious riots in India? Because if you look at the intensity of riots, so these are the number of people arrested, killed, and injured in riots, that intensity over the same period from our data is actually going down. So while for other reasons, such as social cohesion, we may be worried about religious riots, from the perspective of economics, the graph shows that maybe it's not such a problem if the intensity of these riots has actually been going down over time. It really is against this kind of wider backdrop that we've been conducting our research on the economics of religion in India. And we think that one reason why riot intensity might be going down is non-religious service provision. Now, this research project that we've been doing is conducted with Dr. Chanda Velu of the Department of Engineering here in Cambridge and Dr. Melvin Weeks, one of my colleagues at Economics. And our research project asks a very simple question. How do religious organizations provide and change their religious and non-religious services in response to inequality and the competition for adherence? We think the question is important because we know very little about the economic activities of religious organizations in developing countries, and especially in India, which, as I've shown you, is home to all of the world's main religions. In this context, our research involved conducting the first Indian economic survey of religious organizations to understand their economic and competitive behavior, particularly with respect to service provision. And second, we develop a theoretical economic framework that draws upon industrial organization and game theory to argue that the strength of religious beliefs might be related to inequality, religious competition, and non-religious service provision. To obtain data on these issues, we conducted, to the best of our knowledge, the first large-scale economic survey of religious institutions in India between 2006 and 2010, and our data were collected by fieldwork and questionnaire methods on 568 religious organizations, of which there were about 272 Hindu organizations, 248 Muslim organizations, 25 Christian, 23 Sikh and Jain organizations. The organizations themselves were temples, mosques, churches, but also some ashrams, madrasas, and charities. And the data cover demographics, religious service provision, innovations to religious practice, non-religious service provisions such as education and healthcare, adherence, donations, and expenditures. For those of you who may be less familiar with India, our survey was conducted in the seven Indian states of Jammu and Kashmir, Uttar Pradesh, Gujarat, Karnataka, Madhya Pradesh, West Bengal, and Maharashtra, so roughly north, south, east, west, and central. And just this is a sample of the organizations that we spoke to, for example, in Gujarat. Some of them include madrasas that, in addition to providing religious teaching based on the Quran and the Sunnah, also teach things like Shakespeare, computer-based learning, and economics. The way we chose our religious organizations was to randomly sample them from a listing of all religious organizations under the Registrar of Charities. And I should emphasize that the survey was an extremely challenging task of planning, coordination, and execution. I should also emphasize the very sensitive nature of the questions that we asked and the respondents. To avoid the possibility that we might be inducing a bias in the responses associated with the same person answering all the questions, typically, we interviewed three people in each organization, a temple trustee, an administrative officer, and a financial officer, and they look like this. You've got the trustee in the middle and the other two on either side. And we also made repeat visits and conducted semi-structured conversations to understand the ethos of the organization, to view the services provided, and to collect pamphlets that they published to provide external validity to the responses. This photograph, for example, was taken when I was conducting one of the repeat visits in North India. Now, this kind of semi-structured interview approach, which is being used very intensively in census and survey data, allowed us to probe intensively to get around some of the statistical issues that economists care about of identification, measurement error, common method bias, and correlated responses, with which we do need to look out for these kinds of surveys. Our responses were recorded in the local language, and they were subsequently translated into English centrally in New Delhi. Now, one of the questions that we asked in our survey was, would you describe your organization as religiously a very strong, strong, mild, or very mild? And what you're seeing in the graph here is the strength of religious beliefs on the x-axis, the percentage of organizations on the y-axis. And I think what is very striking when you look at this is that the Hindus and the Muslims were much more likely to describe themselves as very strong, and others were more likely to describe themselves as very mild. We also asked them what kinds of religious services services these organizations provided. And these included things like propagation of the faith, religious education, weddings, funeral and divorce services, and others. And again, if you look at the data, what you see is that for the Hindus, propagation and expansion of the faith seems to be the most important. But what I think is striking is that for all the minority communities, religious education seems to be crucial. Why are we actually finding this? I think it might reflect something that I've written about in previous work as well, the lack of provision in the public sector schooling system for a minority education. Another very interesting aspect of the religious services was the manner in which technology and the media were increasingly being used to promote them. For example, many Hindu temples are using the internet and video technology to screen weddings or funeral ceremonies in real time to relatives of families who live outside India. They also used mobile phone technology to keep in touch with their congregations, so much so that we even found a mobile phone handset shaped like the head of Lord Ganesh, complete with orange ears, an elephant trunk, and a Hindu holy mark on the forehead. The phone is called Sumukha, which is one of the names of Ganesh, which means pleasant face. The purpose of our survey was really interdisciplinary. It was in part to examine the economics of religion, but it was also to look at changes to contemporary religious beliefs and practice. So to give you an example, one of the questions we asked was, what elements in your belief system have received more emphasis from your organization, and which elements have received less emphasis? And I think our responses overall showed that almost all aspects of belief systems had received more emphasis. This included worship at places of worship, women going to places of worship, as also religious beliefs such as belief in God and spirituality. Interestingly, worship at home and a belief in fate received far less emphasis. And I think this is one of the more interesting changes we found, because Hinduism does not typically emphasize communal worship. We were also interested in social practices associated with religion as well as religious beliefs. So we asked questions such as, which social practices associated with religion have been newly adopted and which have been abandoned? And this table is essentially showing you the response to various changes in social practices. I think this table, again, shows us that the influence of caste was much less than I would have expected, although marriage within the caste is viewed as being roughly the same. A majority of the organizations thought that a later age at marriage occurs and that remarriage for both men and women is widely acceptable. Child marriage and untouchability, so this is the practice of discrimination against the lower caste, are viewed as practices that are being increasingly abandoned. And as regards demographic matters, so this is something that I've been very interested in previous research, having large families was generally being abandoned, and organizations believed that son preference was increasingly being abandoned too, although I should say there were significant interstate variations in the responses to this particular question. Moving on to the non-religious services, so these are services for which there are secular substitutes available. The most common non-religious services that we found were education, health, food distribution, employment, childcare, and other services. And to give you an example of what some of these non-religious services looked like, they were things like English language education, computer classes for younger devotees, book distribution, sari distribution, flood relief, blood donation, medical camps where you can get both checkup and medicine for 1 rupee only, and also very interesting lending schemes, microfinance and cow lending schemes, which help farmers and others deal with adverse income shocks. The graph is again showing you the percentage of organizations by religion providing a particular non-religious service. Again, Hindus are in red, Muslims in green, Christians in blue, and Sikhs and Jains in yellow. And I think, again, the religious variations are actually quite striking. The Muslims and Christians seem to provide the most education services, whereas the Hindus are providing more by way of food distribution. The Christians are providing education, health, and childcare. This is a picture that I've brought to show you of what food distribution actually looks like. You can see people sat on the ground, food is being served on stainless steel thalis and by temple volunteers. The religious organizations were very proud of the provision on these non-religious services. I thought I'd bring you a view from the field. This is a particular cleric who said that people wake up on an empty stomach here, but no one will go to bed on an empty stomach. Some of the non-religious services also involved building communal harmony. For example, this was a cricket match between a local mosque and a Hindu temple. I'm not going to say more about this because, as you all know, cricket is a whole other religion in South Asia. So the bottom line on our fieldwork revealed that all the religious organizations provide religious and non-religious services, and that there are very important variations amongst them in the kinds of services that they are actually providing them. So, how would an economist think about some of our findings theoretically? Now, I should own up and say upfront that many other disciplines, notably philosophy, sociology, politics, and anthropology, have suggested numerous ways to think about religious beliefs. So here, we're simply offering our ideas from economics as a complement to other ways of thinking about religion. And so we argue from economics that it might be useful to think about these organizations through the lens of industrial organization and game theory. And what we do is analogous to a very classic model in economics called the hoteling model of price and location competition. So here we're actually thinking of religious organizations as sellers who act competitively in the market for non-religious services to attract adherents, who we think of as buyers, by differentiating themselves on their strength of religious beliefs and by their non-religious service provision. So we can think of a really simplified economy where, supposing you have two religious organizations, and for each organization, they are competing for adherents, possibly due to political, monetary, or other benefits from having a large number of adherents. And each organization is trying to attract those adherents by choosing what we call a focal point, which is essentially the strength of religious beliefs. Each organization is also going to provide non-religious services, which we assume the poor are going to value more than the rich because the rich already have them. So each organization here is maximizing essentially the net benefit per adherent. So they're maximizing the adherents subject to the cost of actually providing non-religious services for them. Just like the organizations, each adherent in this model is also choosing membership of a particular religious organization, and we think that for each adherent, that choice is actually going to be based on two factors. It's going to be based on their personal focal point relative to the religious organization's focal point, and it's going to be based on wealth benefits from membership of a religious organization. Again, we're going to assume that the poor are going to value these non-religious services more than the rich, because the rich already have them. So our model assumes that the adherents are going to maximize their utility by minimizing the distance in the focal points between themselves and the religious organizations, and maximizing the amount of non-religious services that the religious organization actually provides them. It leads in economics to a classic game theoretic problem where the organizations need to choose a religious focal point and to decide upon the non-religious services provided, but they need to do this by taking into account what the other organization is also doing while they are both competing for adherence in this religious market. We then look at what happens to the solution when we add economic inequality across the sample of populations in the economy. So, just to remind you, we have our simple economy with two religious organizations, and we're assuming that their strength of religious beliefs is distributed on a unit interval from 0 to 1. We have our happy adherents, and they're distributed across the spectrum of the strength of religious beliefs. Remember that they're going to consider the distance between their personal religious focal point and the organization's focal point. Both the religious organizations need to decide they need to compete with each other to decide where to position themselves on this scale of 0 to 1. We also assume that there's some inequality in the population, so some are poorer and some are richer, and this is going to create the demand for non-religious services like education and healthcare. We think the poor are going to value these services more than the rich because the rich already have them. The religious organizations also need to provide non-religious services, and they're going to maximize the number of adherents by choosing both their religiousness as well as their non-religious services. And each organization is going to do this taking into account what the other organizations are also doing. In our work, what we're doing especially is to emphasize the dependence of the religious decision and the service decision on each other. And what we find when we solve the model mathematically is that the religious organizations are going going to maximize the differentiation of their religious focal points. What that means in plain English is one is going to locate at zero and the other one is going to locate at one. They won't locate in the middle. Why? Because if they locate in the middle, they would have to provide lots of services and they're competing with the other one, other organization. They will also never choose the same point, because if they did so, one organization could simply offer a few more services and then they would corner the whole market. But if they did that, then they would compete away all of their profits. And technically, for the economists here, what we show in the paper is that both organizations would get zero profits in the subgame, hence they would never do this. We also show mathematically in our paper that the optimal levels of service provision for both of these organizations, which we calculate, is greater when you have some inequality in the population compared to a situation when you have no inequality. So when we solve this game theoretic model mathematically, we essentially obtain two key propositions: that in the presence of competition in the provision of non-religious services, the religious organizations differentiate their religious focal points, and that the provision of non-religious services by the organizations increases when there is a change in economic inequality. Why do we get proposition one? Because we're showing that the organizations are differentiating themselves religiously in order to minimize the amount that they have to compete in providing non-religious services. And proposition two says that when economic inequality is rising, the organizations have to provide more non-religious services because the poor are going to value and use these more, and again, the organizations are competing for more adherence amongst them. Empirically, what we then do is to use our religion data to test whether the propositions generated by the theoretical model are then supported empirically in the data. And what we find is that the religious organizations in India are differentiating themselves on the strength of religious beliefs, and that they provide more services in response to competition, and that these organizations are providing more non-religious services in response to a change in the perception of inequality. So how do we actually show this? We conduct a range of statistical tests. So these are essentially multinomial goodness of fit tests on our variable which measures the strength of religious beliefs. Now, what these tests are essentially doing is they're testing if agents in discrete locations are going to be more agglomerated or dispersed than would be predicted by random choice. That is, if they were choosing their beliefs randomly. And here, what we're doing is actually we're borrowing from a very large literature in urban economics, which uses these tests to look at the agglomeration behavior of firms. So we're simply taking the idea from the agglomeration literature and we're applying it to the study of religion. We're also testing for the effects of religious competition on the strength of religious beliefs. So one of the questions that we asked the organizations was whether they provided a new service because other organizations in their area also provided a new service, and we examine if this affected the strength of religious beliefs. But in order to conduct these statistical tests, we also need to control for a whole host of other factors that might be affecting the outcome. Some of these factors are at the level of the organization. Some are religious networks, the presence of riots, and other effects. And we do so by actually including variables such as the organization's age, their adherence, their expenditures, their donations, their location, if they had formal religious networks with other organizations, if religious riots had taken place in their areas of operation, and so forth. So these are the various measures that we were also controlling for. What did we actually find? Based on the sort of positive and significant likelihood ratio and other test statistics, we find that the organizations are dispersed more widely than would be expected if they were choosing their beliefs independently of each other. So here we're simply showing these tests when we don't have the controls and then we have the controls. The results are not qualitatively different, and we think that this provides initial evidence at least that the religious organizations in India are choosing to differentiate themselves with respect to other organizations. To refine this proposition even further, we're really looking at whether competition between the organizations in the same area in the provision of a new religious service also affects the distribution of the strength of religious beliefs. And here we're estimating ordered probit models with competition variables, and again we're including organization level controls. What we're simply doing here is reporting the results with and without the controls. And essentially what this table is showing you, that in the presence of competition in the provision of non-religious religious services. This positively affects the probability of an organization being stronger in its religious beliefs. And this finding is very consistent with the much wider sociological and historical literature on India that has talked about the rise of Hindutva, the radicalization of Hinduism in the post-liberalization period. Our second proposition stated that the provision of non-religious services by the organizations increases when there's a change in economic inequality. So here we were looking at the effect on the provision of education and health services between 1991 and 2006, whether this was better provided for or not. The reason we're particularly interested in this post-1991 period is because, as many of you here will know, the Indian economy undertook a major trade liberalization, industrial deregulation, and export orientation that generated some economic growth, but also fostered a degree of income inequality. And so we're particularly interested in whether in this post-liberalization period the perception of inequality affected the religious organizations' behavior in terms of their provision of education and health services. Now, you would have heard me keep saying perception all the time. Why is it that we're using a perception of inequality variable rather than an actual inequality variable? Simply because actual income inequality at the level of the local market for religion does not exist in Indian data. So we had to ask a question in our survey whether the organization thought that inequality in the district over the past 20 years had actually increased or not. Again, we're including various controls. And what our results very simply are showing is that the average probability of providing more education and health services increases if the organization perceives inequality to have increased. So basically, what does the empirical testing of the two propositions tell us? They tell us that in keeping with the predictions of our theory, we think that organizations in India are differentiating themselves on the strength of religious beliefs, and that this choice is not independent of each other's decisions, but that regardless of this position, the change in the perception of inequality may lead to religious organizations providing more education and health services. So, what is the future of the economics of religion in India? I think that some economists are probably much more interested in religion today than they've been at any other time previously. Research in the economics of religion, not just in India but elsewhere too, is thriving, and it concerns both theoretical work and empirical studies. And drawing a perspective on these studies, it does strike me that emerging economies like India are experiencing appreciable modern economic growth, but this is coterminous with the increasing resilience of religious institutions. And I think it is this dichotomy between the sacred and the secular, which emphasizes the puzzle of the relationship between religion and economic development. It is really in this context that we are hopeful that the outcome of our research is going to have considerable policy relevance. To that end, we conducted the first major economic study of religious organizations in India, examining both their religious and non-religious service provision. We think that these organizations have increased non-religious service provision like education and health because the poor compared to the rich are demanding more of these, and the organizations are simply responding to this demand. I do think that in some ways this is a very positive role that many of them are actually playing in their local communities. So we hope by encouraging economists and others to focus our attention more on these non-religious services, this might actually help better our understanding of how to manage interfaith relations in religiously pluralistic populations. This is because it could be that as the organizations are differentiating themselves more religiously, this simply sets up the potential for greater conflict between them, which could then possibly be mitigated by the very same organizations providing more non-religious services. And perhaps this kind of service provision is one reason why the intensity of religious conflict in India may have decreased. Finally, let me simply end by showing you my favorite picture of religion and service provision in India. This is a picture of a road sign taken in North India. It's a depiction of all the main religions of India: Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Islam, and Christianity, reminding them that they are all Indian as well. Thanks very much for listening.